I'm Gab, he's Jules. We know what the weather is in West London because I was just sent a video and it's snowing right now. It's not snowing here because we're in Doha. But Jules, this is big. The semifinals coming up. We have our final four. We're going to get into that. France are still alive. There you go. And they'll be playing Morocco in that semifinal. Of course, the other semifinal, Croatia and Lionel Messi's Argentina. We're going to get into all that. But let's start at the top. England beating France. Now, I have a confession to make.
France beating England, you mean?
Freudian there. But in terms of performance on the pitch, as we saw, that might be a bit debatable. It was interesting. You were nervous beforehand.
Yeah.
You told me privately that beneath the whole bravado and French insouciance and whatever, you're like, oh, I think we're going to lose to England.
Yeah.
This is funny because our colleague James Ollie, who is extremely tall and therefore extremely wise, what did he say? He says, nah, mate, England are going out. You know why? Because England haven't won a knockout World Cup knockout game away from Wembley since whatever, 19, or maybe even ever. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's a long, long time.
Long time ago.
So that made me think, is it really going to be like that?
However, I thought England were the better side. I have to be honest here. You know, we were at the game, and from what I saw from England, was very good, I have to say. The French took the lead, obviously, early on. I think it was a nervy first 15 minutes from England. But after that, they took control of the game. Between the 15th minute and the 75th minute, they were really on top, and they were really putting France under pressure. And I was struggling in the stand, I won't lie. I was like, Kane scored the penalty straight after the break to make it 1-1. And then at that time, it looked like they were going to go and win it, and only them could go and win it. And we can talk about Southgate a little bit more later, but I thought he didn't really capitalize on that very strong period for the England team, because they were on top. We were really struggling. And I think had he made a few changes there, maybe taking Henderson back out earlier instead of leaving him on the pitch until the 79th minute, I think something else could have happened for England. Instead, at some point, the French kind of regained a bit of momentum and scored that second goal, which was an amazing goal. And then you still had another chance with Kane to take that penalty and level the score.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. What struck me about this was Didier Deschamps' reaction, because obviously there was the bright start from France. There was the early goal. And I thought to myself, okay, Didier, you've got two options here. You're going to be 1998, if only. You're going to be 2018, Didier, and be like, all right, let's make England chase us, let's sit, and let's go and, you know, release the Mbappe on the wing, and we're done. Maybe we get another one, maybe we don't. But Gareth Southgate's going to be scared of the threat of Mbappe over the top, so England aren't going to put us under as much pressure, and when they do, they're going to find a defensive wall. I thought he was going to do that. The alternative would have been, no, I'm going to be positive. I've got Griezmann in my midfield. I've got ballers. We're going to play higher up the pitch. Instead, I felt like it was like an in-between thing.
Yeah, a bit, yeah.
And England really capitalized on that.
Yeah.
I mean, England looked like the accomplished side out there. And France felt like the smaller team.
Especially in the second half, because I thought the first half was too predictable. Tchouaméni was on Bellingham, Rabiot was on Henderson. On Rice, you had either Giroud or Griezmann coming and do that kind of work. And then England didn't really create enough. Once Upamecano made that mistake and Kane had that shot that Lloris saved, then the penalty shout that the foul was clearly out of the box. That's why, outside of the box, that's why it was not given as a penalty. But apart from that, I thought it was a bit predictable from England and quite comfortable for France. The second half, however, it was very different. Early goal from that first Kane penalty, and then it was wave after wave. The Maguire header, the Bellingham volley, the Shaw cross that Theo kind of like put out and Saka behind him. All of that, I thought France then now have to show some resilience, have to show some mental strength, have to be ruthless in the sense that let's not concede and then we will have one more chance and we'll have to make it count. And that's exactly what they did.
Let's talk about actually first the foul that was outside the box. I don't think there's any question it was outside the box. But just to be clear, just to explain to viewers who might be wondering, it was obviously very close. But VAR cannot – there's two elements of this, right? There's the was it a foul and was it inside the box element. VAR decide if it was in the box or not. They can decide this on their own, and it's definitive because that's considered an objective an objective issue.
Yeah.
Once they've decided that it's outside the box, they can't ask the referee to come and look and decide and overrule them whether it was inside or outside. And that's why when people say, oh, did it go to VAR? Did it not go to VAR? Why wasn't it on field of view? Like, VAR is checking everything, right? There's four dudes up there, five dudes even.
Five, yeah.
Right? As Pierluigi explained to us.
But do you understand the criticism from the English players and the English media to some extent against the referee? Did you feel the referee had such a bad game?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm trying to think of big decision. Now, obviously, they might have felt it was in the box, but it's not. The referee on the field judges it to be, well, he judges it to be not a foul, actually. But he almost kind of, I thought there was one incident where he almost kind of left it to the VAR, as he certainly did
for the second
with Theo Hernandez on Mason Mount, right? You know, I don't even know. I mean, I think he could have easily called it on the field, but maybe he chose not to. I don't think there was such an issue with the officiating in this game. I think he did whistle. He let a little too many things grow. And I think that could be a criticism of him. Yeah. But then again, when you get the opposite, when you got referees showing too many cards, yes, I'm looking at you, Mateo Larros, or when you have, you know, every little thing is a foul, you get the opposite, right? He's not letting the game flow, blah, 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 you know. So, is it, I mean,
There was a few calls that I thought, and you could see the frustration from the England players around the referee through the whole game, pretty much. Maguire said after the game that in the first 10 minutes, there were five or six fouls from French players, no yellow cards, that kind of stuff, which I can maybe understand. I think it was a bit of the trend this week to complain about referee. Pep did it with Portugal.
We'll be getting to
obviously
that.
Argentina and the Netherlands did it as well. The English a bit last night. What I thought, though, and that kind of is related to the referees, that I thought England let the emotion sort of like kind of overwhelm them. And you look at Bellingham, he's an amazing talent. He was very good, I thought, last night. But every time the ref was giving a foul against him or a foul against England, he was going mad. He was like this. He was shaking his head. And I really felt that the emotion got to them. And I think in a game like that, that is so tight, when there's really not much between the two teams and it's a quarterfinal of the World Cup, you can't let the emotions almost overriding you, if you see what I mean. You need to almost cut the emotions out. And then I treat that game as something so ruthless, like, whether it's against you or for you, the fight, it doesn't matter so much. You've moved on already. You forgot. You're in position. If the fight is against you, if the fight is for you, you've already thinking about what you're going to do with the ball. And I thought England didn't deal with that at all.
So a theory was put out by a colleague of ours, Tim Vickery, who's based in Brazil, that this particular referee is somebody who has a reputation in South America for actually calling a lot of fouls, calling a lot of contact and stuff like that. He comes into a World Cup environment where I think we've seen the trend around Europe and with FIFA as well is, no, let the game flow. Don't call little ticky-tacky fouls. And maybe he exaggerated too much in that direction.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that could be an explanation. Did you feel that England missed? This is the other impression I got. And again, you were there. I only saw this on television, but England missed the width of the fullbacks that they would normally get. Now, with Walker, we can understand a little bit because, obviously, he's up against Kylian Mbappe. On the other flank, arguably as well, Shaw's got to deal with Ousmane Dembele. But that kind of robbed England a little bit of the regular overlap, of the overload in midfield.
Yeah, a little bit. There's that cross from Shaw in the second half that we mentioned before that Theo puts out for a corner with Saka just behind him. Maybe, I think we knew before that Walker was not going to do at all any of that because he was clearly too busy with Kylian. And by the way, I think that the first France goal, in a way, is the result of that over-focusing on Kylian Mbappe and the defending, because there's three players that goes and try to close him down when Upamecano recovers the ball.
Walker was almost never left one-on-one with,
and when he was in the second half, Kylian outpaced him.
Yeah. I mean, Walker, I thought, played an exceptional game.
Yeah, yeah.
And really, that was the only time I felt that Mbappe beat him. And look, let's not forget, we can debate who's quicker, whatever. Mbappe's also 10 years younger or thereabouts, like Kyle Walker. So, whatever. I did feel as if this is the threat. Let's go and double. And that was another thing. if you know they're always taking an extra man, why not switch it up more often to Dembele on the other
side?
Yeah,
maybe.
Or go through the middle. And I thought one of the reasons, you know, Antoine Griezmann, I thought, was praised to high heaven. I think a lot of people had him as man of the match, although my man of the match, of course, will always be Olivier Giroud.
Yeah.
But I thought also that focus on that side gave Griezmann more space in the middle.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And just to go back quickly on that goal, Rice, Bellingham and Walker all chasing down Kylian, who still manages to get out of that three. Rice is then too short. And then the ball goes wide, as you just mentioned, comes back onto Tchouaméni, who shoots and scores. And Bellingham is maybe half a second late and the ball goes between his legs, because I think that move from Kylian Mbappe just unbalanced completely the whole team. Like, they were all over the place for 30 seconds maybe, but that was enough for France to score. So yes, they kept Kylian quiet, and by doing that you meant no Walker going forward. But you're right, I think Shaw could have done a little bit more, but maybe they were also a bit scared of Dembele on the other side.
I'm going to get the Kane penalty in the match. Actually, no, let's talk about Kane penalty now. I don't want to talk about substitutions, your favorite subject.
Oh my god. Yeah, please get me started on that.
So much debate on my television here in Qatar and on BN Sport afterwards, especially one guy in particular, going on and on about how it was a mistake to let Harry Kane take another penalty against
his mate,
Hugo Lloris. Right now, I guess the logic is they're club teammates and so they know each other. But he already made one penalty. Is this a rule in football? I don't understand.
No, I don't think so.
You need to change him. If you're playing against your club teammate and you scored one penalty, somebody else has taken another penalty. Is this some unwritten rule I'm not familiar with?
No. I agree with you. I don't think there was even a debate on like who should take that second penalty.
So it was only here.
Okay. It's only that guy being sport. I didn't watch being sport, so I don't know. But even rewatching the game this morning, I was like, I don't think there's any problem. You don't see any England player. You don't see Southgate doing something. Clearly, the pen is the pen. Kane takes the ball. And by the way, Kane doesn't play for Frankfurt, does he? Because 2 months ago in the Champions League, he scored a pen in the game. And then right at the end, 90th minute, he's got a second pen. And he blasted it over the bar, exactly like he did yesterday. So I don't think it's anything to do with Lloris being in front of him. I just think that maybe, to do it twice in 2 months, it's a bit... So maybe he didn't deal well with that kind of pressure of taking another pen. And that game against Frankfurt, they were 3-2 up with a few seconds, like a minute to go. So they would have won the game anyway. They won it 3-2 instead of 4-2 had he scored. But I don't think that's got anything to do with Lloris. However, I can see that it must be difficult to shoot against someone who knows you so well, who's been your friend for 10 years, who trains with you every day. I get it. But he knows Lloris as well. He knows where Lloris is.
100% he knows Lloris. And the other thing is, you know, we're going to lift the lid on a secret here. It's not like professional footballers spend their time taking penalties against each other.
That's true.
So to me, it's, you know, it is kind of non... In fact, it's more likely, I would assume, that Kane at club level would probably take penalties against a backup goalkeeper or your team goalkeeper.
The third goalkeeper.
And Lloris would probably be training with himself with a goalkeeping coach taking penalties against them, right?
It's kind of the way
professional football works.
Yeah, completely.
Substitutions. Bukayo Saka, I thought, was maybe England's best player or right up there.
I agree.
Were you surprised that he was the guy to come off?
Completely. I mean, there were talks.
Was he unfit? I don't think I could think of.
There were talks after that maybe he was injured, that he picked up an injury. I have to say, I didn't see it on the pitch. And that substitution from Saka bothered me massively. But what bothered me the most, Gabby, is that Raheem Sterling replaced him. Now, I've got nothing against Raheem Sterling. I think he's an amazing player. But what on earth would you bring on someone in a game like this when you've just conceded the second goal, so you're 2-1 down, someone who spent 5 days in London, who's just flown over there from Doha to London, 7 hours, three hours difference in the time difference, dealt with something that was quite traumatic to his family, clearly, because he felt the need to go back to London. Has just come back from London to Doha, 7 hour flight, the other 3 hours back into the other way. Had not trained, or like a little bit the day before the game. And you think it's a good idea, with all the players that you've got on your bench, to bring on Raheem Sterling for the last 20 minutes, 10 minutes of normal time and 10 minutes of added time? Really?
Yeah. I would have thought at that stage, the obvious guy to bring on, and we saw him, I think he came on in injury time, was Jack Grealish.
Exactly.
For the simple idea, and look, I'm not having a go at Jack Grealish, this is part of the game. The logical, Jack Grealish gets the ball, what does he do? He goes, he puts his head down, he starts dribbling, he falls over, he gets fouled. And then you have a set piece,
yeah,
right? And then you've got people who can deliver the set piece well. You can bring up Maguire and his large head. You've got Harry Kane in there. You've got, you know,
completely.
You've got a threat in an area where, you know, France had Giroud, who I don't know if he said he was injured after the game, but he certainly, obviously, he battled all the way through.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, France, defensively, set pieces, it's basically the center backs, Rabiot and Giroud, right?
Yeah, that's all.
England, many more weapons. They're a good set piece team. They created chances with them, with a stack, with their movement. This really surprised me.
It made no sense from Southgate. And I don't want to pick on him because England played really well and we're not here to criticize Southgate. However, I just don't, at that level, every detail counts. As we've been saying before in the preview, and the game was too tight. For Southgate not to make an earlier substitution before the 79th minute when he was 2-1 down was a mistake. To take off Saka was a mistake. To bring on Sterling was a mistake as well. And in the end, that might not have cost England the game. I don't know. We will never know. But those three moments there, I felt were mistakes from Southgate and showed once more, it's not the first time, once more, how much his in-game management is not good enough for that kind of level. It's as simple as that.
Now, there's an interesting twist going on here, right? We live in England. We both lived there for a long, long time. And if you haven't lived there, you've heard about the tabloid press and how aggressive they can be and how they go and they destroy England after every tournament, unless England win the tournament, which hasn't happened in my lifetime. So, most people's lifetime. This time around, the reaction is actually very positive about Southgate. Now, I think on the one hand, that shows a ton of maturity because they look at this and say, okay, England scored 6 against Iran. They had a bit of a stinker against the United States, but still, they didn't lose. Okay, Wales, you can only beat what's in front of you, right? They beat Senegal, which I don't think is a game to be taken for granted
Definitely
at all.
Not.
And then they get this far, and they outplay the world champions, you know, who are arguably a more talented side.
Yeah.
So that's all positive. I still think the English media, pre-Southgate, if they come back after a run like that, they still get hammered. They still get killed. This time around, there's so much positivity. Is it the English media that have grown up? Or is it the fact that Southgate is legitimately a nice guy, a classy guy? He says the right things.
Yeah, and I think he's pacified. He has pacified. Like, he made peace, really, between the tabloids, especially, and the England camp, the England players. They are, I think, happier to talk to the media, for example, which before, I think, was a chore, really, let's be honest. They do stuff like they go and play darts together in the England camp, you know, a journalist against a player, all that kind of banter, if you want, which I think is helping. Let's just not go over the board with all the niceness and all the positivity as well.
Do you think there's still criticism of Southgate and the way and his choices in this game?
Yeah.
I would tend to agree. I mean, I think there's progress because we saw, I thought 2020 England were just exceptionally negative throughout the tournament. And yeah, they got to the final and the stupid thing where they said, oh, that's how France won a World Cup. Let's play the same way. I told you, this stuff does not work.
That's no way.
You can get lucky, but it doesn't work.
That's true.
I thought they played to their strengths a lot more. I think Southgate's on a path. And if I were an England fan, I would definitely want Gareth Southgate to stay.
Yeah, I can understand that. You can see the progression. There's no doubt. So yeah, they were just beaten by a team that, if you don't kill that team off, like England had the chance and didn't do it, then they will come back and kill you off. And I think that's exactly what the French show. And I think that ruthlessness is what's missing a little bit now for England. I think they're such a nice bunch. And you said Southgate is such a nice guy, which is true. I think to go and win something big now, they need to be tougher. They have to be meaner. They have to make that, to have that kind of killer instinct that they clearly don't have. Otherwise, we would have seen it last night. And I think the French, on the other hand, went far from perfect. Let's not forget, there's no Conte, no Benzema, no Pogba.
I knew we were going to come up with all these.
But how
guys.
Good are we to go into the last four in the semi-final when we have half of the country missing? Come on.
Yeah, Conte, Benzema, and Pogba. Like, I think two of those three guys have played, what, like 3 games
doesn't
more
matter.
Than you have in the last
matter.
Year?
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Why don't you go further? There's no Jules Fontaine. There's no Raymond Coppa. There's no Michel
Platini.
They
were not available. They were busy, apparently. So.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Enough England. How about some quick hits instead?
Let's go, Gab.
Morocco defeat Portugal 1-0. Jules, the fairy tale continues.
Incredible. I don't know what to say anymore. We didn't see them being able to do it again, to have another miracle, to upset another big team, big European team. We thought they were tired. We thought they were injured. We thought they couldn't do it with only half of their back four, and yet they go again, and it was probably even more convincing than against Spain, because they scored a goal, they had chances, they frustrated Portugal and all their attacking power and all of that. Wow. I mean, I don't know what to say anymore.
So I was at this game, and obviously it was tremendous, the support from the Morocco fans, and whatever else. Your man, Fernando Santos, not following my advice, puts in Gonzalo Ramos because, you know, you don't want to mess with the team that's winning.
Yeah.
Zara Ramos was absolutely terrible.
Dire.
You know what? I thought he was worse than Diogo Costa in this game. And I know people gave Diogo Costa the lowest mark because he made the mistake on the goal. Which, by the way, I thought Ruben Dias didn't help either.
Me too.
It's almost like Diogo Costa got all the mistake and Ruben Dias kind of was kind of giving a pass.
I agree completely with you.
But we'll get to Cristiano in a minute. But what struck me was, and this is kind of a function of World Cup knockout football, and it's become really clear to me. One team goes a goal up, and then in the second half, it's no longer football as we understand it. It's no longer about formations and pressing and ebb and flow. No, you have one team sitting deep. They didn't necessarily sit as deep as they did against Spain.
No.
But they're defending and trying to hit on the counter. That's kind of all that they're doing. They're not necessarily trying even to retain possession when they win it back. I'm talking about Morocco. And Portugal, it is just an absolute mess of attacking players. Bernardo Silva, who also had a very rough game, at one point, he's playing defensive midfielder. He is the last man. He's the man shielding the two center backs. Now, if there's a counter and big man runs through, do you think Bernardo Silva can foul him? He's not going to win the ball off him. Do you think he can even keep up with him? He just sent on so many attacks. Like, let me send on all my attacking players at once. Bruno Fernandes, you know where he ends when he finishes the game? At right back.
Yeah, I saw, yeah.
Do you know where João Cancelo started the game? On the bench.
Yeah, again.
I don't want to be harsh. I don't want to make this all about Cristiano. We'll get to Cristiano. But you have to have a way of playing. You have to have a way of playing. It's halftime, 45 minutes, we're a goal down. We are more talented than the opposition. We're not going to turn this into a crazy free-for-all siege of the Alamo this early in the game because it just makes no sense.
But what have we said from the beginning? Fernando Santos is a defensive coach. He's a conservative coach. You can't just switch and turn the light, literally turn the switch on and go, okay, let's attack now. Let's play nice, flowing football. The Switzerland game was a fluke. It was against a team that had lost all their bearings, that had players missing, that clearly their head coach made a wrong call tactically, and that was it. And Gonzalo Ramos was literally on fire. But you can't, if you don't work on it, if you don't work on your structure, if you don't work on how you can play with the ball with all your attacking talent, it's not by just putting them all on the pitch that it's going to happen. That's not football for you. It looked to me, and I was only watching on TV, but it looked to me like they almost didn't, it was a pickup game. Portugal play the pickup game, yeah, like we do in the park here with the ESPN people that you'd never played with each other before.
Well, it's worse because when they play the park here, they have somebody, giving all these instructions. You win. Press there, you cover him, double him.
Exactly.
And yeah, this is completely different.
And that, I promise you, Gabby, I don't know from you in the stadium, but for me, it looked like they didn't know each other. They never played with each other before. How is that even possible?
It was absolute chaos. Now, obviously, they still had their chances because they're great players. But it occurred to me, even if Portugal were going to equalize, like, how are they going to play 30 minutes of extra time with Bruno at right back?
Yeah.
How is this going to work? You know,
I lost all sort of shape and
it
form.
It was just such a letdown. Now, they still had the chance at the end. Pep missing at the far post.
Cristiano as well.
So who?
Cristiano on that through ball. You know that it's the first time and Bruno makes a
good
save.
I will get to that in a minute. The Pep one, I thought, you know, I'm not going to blame him. The man is 40 years old. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
But the other thing, with that chaos, came this nervy frenzy every 3 seconds. João Félix screaming, throwing his hands in the air. Bruno Fernandes doing that thing where he goes like this, like he's going to go Hulkamaniac and rip his shirt off. Pep constantly with the referee, blah, blah, blah.
Always.
I mean, guys, really?
I know.
Why don't you let your talent impose yourself on the opposition by turning it into a demolition derby? It served Morocco's purposes because they have the crowd going, because you have Amrabat, who, again,
so good. So good.
Amrabat and Unahi, I compared them to, you know, Castor and Pollux from Greek mythology. Those two guys are absolute monsters in the middle of the park. Incredible. France, beware when you play those guys. Unahi has so much quality.
Yeah.
Amrabat, so much drive. But I mean, tremendous.
Yeah, and just the heart that they have, and just for, I mean, what this means for African football to start with, first ever team to qualify for the semi-final of the World Cup, for Moroccan football, of course, as well, for Arab football too, to see that team doing so well, playing with so much heart, so much solidarity. For all the Huyas in the world, well done to you. I hope he stops in the semi-final, just so you know. Gab, Cristiano Ronaldo came on 6 minutes into the second half, 10 touches, one shot that we mentioned briefly before, and a lot of anger from Georgina, obviously, his wife, and from his sister.
So, I wrote this in my piece. It's an excellent piece. It's on the website. Very informative. You check it out. I was struck by how calm Cristiano was when he went on. You remember that thing he used to do when he says, like, calma, eu estou aqui. You know, like, I'm here. Don't worry about it. Nothing to worry about. I really thought that's what he wanted to channel. I may have been giving him too much credit. I'm trying to get into his mind too much. He saw everybody else losing their mind. You know, Bruno Fernandes with stuff coming out of his mouth. And he's saying, I'm going to be here. I'm going to be calm. It'll come. This is my moment. I'm going to score. I'm going to prove Fernando Santos wrong. I'm going to prove the haters wrong. And he just didn't get in the ball. And the one pass that they got, It was interesting because it was a pass from Bruno Fernandes deep in his new right back position, in fact.
Exactly.
And I was curious because he beats the defender of the ball. And I thought, okay, you could see he's getting to the ball first. I'm like, does he take a touch or does he strike it first time? He struck it first time.
Yeah.
He struck it cleanly, but he struck it straight at Bruno.
Yeah.
And then when he went over to try to, you know, and then Bruno was quick on the scramble afterwards. That was his moment.
That was his moment.
That was his shot.
Exactly.
But again, I go back to this. 10 touches. So you, Portugal, right, leaving aside the decision to drop him, which I said, you know, I think was a wrong decision to drop him in a game like this. But you give this guy 39 minutes plus injury time. You're attacking the whole time. And all you can do is give him 10 touches.
I know. I agree. I agree with you.
This is all you can do.
I agree with you. Yeah, completely. I agree with you completely. It's crazy. And it's sad. And then the tears afterwards, whether you think he pushed you a little bit or not, whether you think he's genuine or not, this is not the point. This was his last ever World Cup match. This is not how you want, if you're Cristiano Ronaldo, one of the greatest
Miller,
ever.
So he's going to be 41 in 2026. Roger Miller was 42 when he played and scored for Cameroon in a World Cup match.
I would love to see that.
It's interesting because his face was just like a mask of calm. Even at the final whistle, he turns around and he walks straight down. One of the one of the players, Dari, I think, the Ashraf Dari, the center back, one of the Morocco players, actually, they're all celebrating. He sees Cristiano. He stops. He puts his arms around him, tries to console him. Cristiano gives him a nod. And then he just keeps walking. Then this other guy, cameras, I think, might have missed this. Some other guy who looked like he was a fan who jumped in, starts running towards him. He's tackled by security guard. Cristiano kind of does a step. Otherwise, he does not break stride, goes straight down the tunnel. And I was struck by how calm he was. Now, I didn't see at the time the cameras in the tunnel showing him crying. He certainly kept it in. I think it was almost like he didn't want to give anybody the satisfaction.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, plenty of Portugal players were very unhappy with the referee,
yes.
Facundo Teo. Do they have a point?
So the point that Pep made, for example, he said, how can an Argentinian referee, after what happened the night before in the Argentina-Netherlands game, you know, what Messi said, what all of them said, he's allowed to referee that game, which I thought was a bit pushing it. I don't know why in Argentina, I don't know what that's got to do with him refereeing Portugal against Morocco, right?
Yeah, let me explain it. In Pep land, there is a conspiracy for Lionel Messi to win this World Cup. And so all the other referees are working hard to knock out all the best teams.
Okay,
like
I missed that.
Portugal, I guess.
I missed that.
Well, Brazil, right? Knocked out. Not by an Argentine referee, but England.
Yeah, knocked out. Not by an Argentine referee either, but okay, maybe. However, I think the other point that he made, and I thought this one was more valid, was that second half was stop and go all the time because the ref was blowing for a lot of fouls, and maybe he could have let the game flow a little bit more, maybe in which would have been in favor of Portugal. And
why would letting the game flow have been in Portugal's favor? I'm trying to understand Pep line. And by the way, most of the time when you're involved, it's because you either foul somebody
true.
Or because you act like a maniac and get in the referee's face afterwards,
That's true.
But how would it have... I would have thought that actually, with all the set-piece takers and everything that Portugal have, and with Morocco being, let's face it, the more physical of the two teams, I thought you'd want a referee calling for fouls.
They're very good on set-pieces too. Up to the Pep chance, apart from that, they had dealt well with set-pieces too, so... I don't know. I thought maybe that watching the second half on television, it felt like it was a bit stop and go. And it's hard to then get a rhythm if you're Portugal when you're chasing a game. And that benefited massively for Morocco. But again, maybe in the stadium you had a different vibe about it, a different feel about it.
One guy got sent off in this game. And guess what? He's not Portuguese.
He's your mate.
Italian.
You mentioned the other day.
Walid Khedira, I already know. Yeah. Who managed to get... I felt so bad for him. He's so upset. He comes on. His job is to run around.
Yeah. That you can do.
And he gets two yellow cards in the space of a minute. Oh, and the other dude, the one-on-one that he missed on the counter, the number 14, I'm blanking on his name, I apologize.
I can't remember who it was either. He tried to chip it over Diogo Costa and missed it completely.
Well, dude, what are you doing?
I know, like, go around him.
Either go around him and score, or just take the ball in the corner and wait for Pepe to come and foul you.
Exactly.
You know, but whatever.
Back to Ronaldo, he won his 196th cap to equal the world record, and he has suggested that he will continue. The world record was from Bader, who played for Kuwait.
Well, no, not who played. Who played. This is the interesting thing. So, by the way, obviously, before people jump on us, this is the men's record.
Yes, sorry.
The women's record, I believe, is Christine Sinclair, who I believe has 1,826 caps.
And 1,700 goals as well.
She has like 190 odd goals, but you know she's like 39 years old or something.
That record would never be beaten.
She started playing.
She was 16 or something with the national team.
Yeah, when I saw her at the 2012 Olympics, I thought she'd be like 22, 23, right? No, she was like 29. She was old then. Not old, but getting there now. She's a phenomenal athlete.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough Christine Sinclair. Let's talk about Cristiano. So. Badr Al-Mutawa, who I have to say I was not familiar with.
No, I mean, I thought he had retired, to be fair.
Sorry?
I thought he had retired recently, to be fair.
He's still playing. He's still active. So I love the idea of Cristiano Ronaldo, who has the men's goal-scoring record, obviously wants the appearance record as well, continuing to play as long as this guy, Badr Al-Mutawa, plays.
Badr?
What?
How old is Badr? Did you remember?
He's the same age. He's like... 2 or 3 months older than Cristiano.
No way.
He made his debut in 2002. Cristiano made it in 2003. Debut for the national team. I love the idea of Badr. How would it be if Cristiano, if Badr just goes to like George Mendes?
Like a dance off, but a cap off.
Like, well, how much money are you going to give me to retire once and for all? Okay, and I'll do that. Otherwise, these two can just keep going forever.
And it's probably easier, no offense to Kuwait, but to play for Kuwait than to... I mean, mind you, Cristiano can play for Portugal for as long as he wants, pretty much.
Exactly. That's a funny story.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the... Did we just hit $1 million stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify is your no excuses business partner. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/gabjules, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/gabjules now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/gabjules.
Croatia play Argentina on Tuesday night. Jules, let's pretend we're both Stuart Robson and try to preview this thing. Obviously, the favorites are Argentina, but I'm more interested in, if you're Dalic, how do you approach it? Because he was very clear before the Brazil game. Okay, yeah, we have the best midfield in the world. Yeah. We're just going to keep the ball.
You do the same against Argentina. Why would you change anything against Argentina? They're a different team to Brazil, but still, the idea and the philosophy have to be the same. What do they hate? They hate running after the ball. Alvarez presses well. Rodrigo de Paul presses well. Messi doesn't press so much. I suspect Argentina will keep that back five. But still, you will be able to make them run if you're Croatia again. And I think...
See, I'm not 100% sure. I'm trying to think like Scaloni. If I'm Scaloni, I can say, all right, hey, boys, you want to go and play like kickabout and keep the ball amongst the three of you in midfield? That's fine. I'm not going to press you. Certainly not the whole time. I might press intermittently when the ball goes to the fullback or whatever. At some point, you're going to have to attack us. And I'm going to have my back five if I keep it, or a back four.
Yeah.
And we're going to get the ball back. And then when we get the ball back, you'll be the one coming to us. And you know, guess what? We're going to give the ball to Lionel Messi. And you don't know where he's going to pop up.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have to get the old guy who looks like Cruyff to chase him. Or you're going to get the bras. Or something's going to happen. And he's going to make something happen.
True.
But, and I'm okay with that.
But even without pressing too high, Argentina will still have to chase the ball. And I think that's exactly what Croatia wants. I love... So Juranovic, the right back, was doing the press conference today. And he said it's safer to give the ball to Modric, Kovacic and Brozovic in midfield and put your money in the bank. And I just thought... I had this image in my head of like, what's safer than the bank safe? Modric, Kovacic, and Brozovic. Okay, no problem.
That's why you should go with crypto. I have a whole bunch of exciting blockchain-related products. No, just kidding. Modric is obviously safer than crypto. We can agree
exactly,
with that, right? Okay.
Neymar is unsure whether he will retire from international football or not, but Gab, there's one Brazilian forward who would like him to stay, and he's a pretty important one.
Yeah, he's somebody Neymar might want to listen to. He is Ore Pelé. Yeah. Obviously, he's had some health issues. Looks like things are a little better now. Obviously, at his age, you know, you just wish him all the best. I think Neymar would want to stick around. Why wouldn't you want to stick around? What are you going to give up on clubs?
He leveled Pelé in terms of goal scores, so he's just one away from...
That's one incentive to continue. But more than that, you've got a good vibe, a good group. Are you thinking in terms of cycle? I say this with the greatest respect to Paris Saint-Germain. This is not a Paul Scholes situation. Oh, I'm going to retire from the national team to focus on my club football with Paris Saint-Germain.
You don't know that.
I am Paris-born and bred, right?
Yeah, but you still don't know that, so maybe you
want to. The dude's from Sao Paulo. I somehow think, I don't want to make assumptions about Neymar, but, you know, if I had to rank, you know, the things that he values most in life, it's from third to first football-wise. Yeah, number three, Paris Saint-Germain. Number two, playing for Brazil. And number one, his sister's birthday every spring.
I knew that
was
coming.
Ah, you knew that was coming. Jules, let's keep talking about Brazilian forwards. Where are we on Endrick?
Well, interestingly, Gab, you asked, because earlier this week, ESPN in Brazil announced that there was an agreement found between Real Madrid with Real Madrid for him to move to Real Madrid. So he can only do it from the summer 2024 because he's too young now. He's only turned 16. So that maybe the Endrick saga could come to an end. We know that a few clubs like PSG and Chelsea were also in the race to sign.
And Barcelona. Xavi couldn't have been more open about it.
Yeah, Xavi met him not that long ago, but it seems that Real Madrid have won the race.
Okay, so you could see, given that Vinicius and Rodrigo aren't exactly old, in a couple of years, you could have an all-Brazilian front line.
That's pretty
With Mbappe coming off the bench.
Oh, and Kylian. Kylian has the front four of Kylian, Vini,
no,
Rodrigo,
I think Mbappe will be backing. I think Kylian will be backing up Vinicius by that point.
Oh, my word. What can we hear?
By the way, Neymar might want to score a few more goals because this kid, Endrick, not to put any pressure on him, you know, you might want to make it a little bit harder for Endrick to beat your record in a few years.
Yeah, okay, maybe. And Gav, even more Brazilian forwards. Rodrigo posted a long apology for his penalty miss against Croatia. Was it necessary, do you think?
So I go on the assumption that everybody's trying to do their best. And if they make a mistake on something like a penalty, unless they feel guilt inside or whatever because they did something differently, if you did your best, it's not necessary. However, if it makes you feel better, if it's a way for you to metabolize the hurt that you feel of missing a penalty, why not apologize for it? I got no problem with it whatsoever.
Yeah.
Let's turn back the clock to the Holland-Argentina game. A lot of folks were unhappy with the behavior in particular of Nicolas Otamendi and Leandro Paredes, among others. Some say it was a giant mind game that helped Argentina win on penalties. There's a guy named Geir Jordet, who is a Norwegian penalty expert. He tweets these long threads about... He's apparently a guy who's featured in the Wall Street Journal recently. He's apparently a guy who analyzes body language and all these factors. We've come across him. He says that this was the key, unsettling the Dutch and so on.
Yeah.
I've shared my thoughts on this whole psychology thing, so I don't need to go there.
I know you don't believe
in it. What's your take?
I was there, to be fair. You could see the aggro. You could see the beef. There's this incredible photo once Lautaro has scored of, obviously, all the other players, you know, are lined up and the Dutch are on the floor and the herd of Argentine run past them and look at them and go like clearly trolling them. Right. I don't know. I think could you have won and maybe be a bit more gracious? Maybe. I thought the Argentine felt there was beef with Van Gaal for what he said before the game, for example, and Martinez told him to shut his mouth. Messi was not happy with Van Gaal, with Edgar Davids. Weghorst was not happy with Messi. So I think there was a lot of tension just overall because of the drama of the game and the scenario of the game. I think the rest, for me, the penalties, and we talked about ruthlessness before with England and France. This is what you have to do to win matches as well. This is not the Care Bear world.
And we have to stop
with that stuff.
I think some level of banter, of trash talk, you know, is part of the game. I have more of an issue with what Paredes did earlier when he goes and he slams the ball at the 100%. Bench. I mean, that's just stupid. And I think if they are going to deal with somebody for something, that is what you deal for.
Yeah, exactly. Sticking with Van Gaal, Gabi has left his post as the Dutch head coach. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, 100% makes sense. The cycle is over. These people think in terms of cycles. I think with a limited team, he made his choice about the football he wanted to play. He took them as far as that football was going to take him. I hope that going forward, Holland have somebody else who's a bit more in line.
So the Dutch guy, because you know the Dutch guy is coming. So,
no.
It is the Dutch guy.
No.
Yeah. The Dutch guy is taking over. Yeah.
You do not like that man, Koeman.
No, that's why I'm so happy.
You do not like him in a van. You do not like his friend Stan. You do not like him in a house. You do not like him if he were a mouse. You do not like that blonde Dutch man.
No, definitely not.
It's and Louis van Gaal's going to take over Argentina after the World Cup. Yeah?
Imagine. Or Belgium. That would be hilarious.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Because for some reason, we're going to have a new ball for the semifinal. It's called Al-Khilm, which I have no idea what that means, so I don't even know why I said it, because whatever. You're the technical expert out of the two of us. Is this a big deal?
I don't think so. It's exactly the same one, different colors.
Apparently, he's got
speed, so he can. The ball travels faster. When we play here at the park with the ESPN brothers, we have one of the ball from the up until now, and it's a really good ball. I have to say, I think this one is exactly the same. I hope so, because I haven't really studied the new.
It's just branding. Okay.
Bad news for Manuel Neuer and Bayern Munich. Good news if you're a PSG fan, if you know any, Gabby. because after the World Cup was not enough, Manuel Neuer broke his leg skiing a few days ago and will not be out for the rest of the season. So, I thought that football players were not allowed to go skiing. I thought it was written on their contract.
I certainly read in most contracts. There's a number of footballers I know who are big
Me
skiers.
Too.
And I've said, oh, no, but I can't.
I love skiing, but I can't do it.
Yeah.
Neuer can.
This is weird. Maybe because he's Manuel Neuer, there's special rules apply to him. It's certainly not something you necessarily want to do. Is anything dangerous?
I know.
First and foremost, though, I feel bad for him.
Yeah.
Because
yeah. No, of course.
He had a horrendous World Cup. I mean, he had a really, really bad World Cup. And then to come back and know he won't be able to help Bayern, by the time he comes back, Bayern could be out of the Champions League. I don't know. I mean, are we capable of feeling some empathy and sorrow for Neuer? I certainly am.
Yeah, you know. No. I am with you at all. I mean, even if you can blame him a bit for going skiing, which maybe was not the greatest of idea, I'm sure he's been skiing many times before, never got injured, but just one fall like he did, and then that's it. So it's a strange one.
Now, you know my belief that Inter are one half of the greatest footballing city in the universe.
Yes.
Bayern aren't too shabby either,
nope.
Jules. And we have the statistical proof now.
That's right, Gab, because now that we know who will be in the semifinal that we mentioned earlier, it's guaranteed that once again, the final of the World Cup, like in every single final since 1982, there will be one player of Inter Milan and one player from Bayern Munich involved in the final, which I find that stats incredible. Every single time since 1982, you've had at least one player of each club involved in the final.
40 years of excellence from Bayern Munich and more so from Inter Milan, which is why prospective buyers and investors in Inter Milan, think about that.
I can't believe you're selling the club.
Think about that. I'm not selling your club any way, shape, or form whatsoever, but just in case, you know, you might be looking for more investment, this is a great selling point and it's hugely relevant.
Manchester City have been linked with my boy, Theo Hernandez. Is that what they need, Gab, left back?
I think unless he wants to play slightly differently, I don't know that he's a natural fit, because
yeah, I agree.
Theo is much more a great player, but he's a north-south, go down
Completely.
The wing, put the cross in, take a shot. Like I look, maybe Guardiola likes variety among his fullbacks, to be fair, because, you know, he's got Cancelo, who's really a number 10,
yeah,
pretending to be a fullback. Zinchenko was the same thing. He's got Kyle Walker, who's much more, I think, of an up-and-down runner. But Kyle Walker's also much better defensively than Theo is.
That's true.
So it wouldn't seem to me like to be a logical fit. Finally, we have a date for when Olympique Lyonnais will be sold, Jules, and maybe we can stop talking about John Textor.
Yeah.
By the way, John, if you want to come on the show, you're welcome anytime.
Yeah, of course.
December 19th.
Yes.
It's a Christmas present.
So only, it was supposed to be September, October, November. Okay, only 3 months late, but better late than never, I guess, right? If you're Olympique Lyonnais, they waited. At some point, they were very pessimistic about the fact that maybe this might not happen. Maybe that was a little bit dodgy. In the end, it seems that John Textor got all the money necessary for it, all the people around him in that consortium, around the table. And now it should be signed on December 19th. So let's wait and see.
Signed on the line that is dotted. But let's wait and see. I think we have another podcast before the holidays. And we might be telling you whether this is done or not.
Exactly. Arsenal have been linked again with Dusan Vlahovic, considering the trouble at Juventus, of course. That would be a good fit.
He was a very good fit when they were first linked to him, like 12 months ago, Jules. I think it would have made a lot of sense. Now, I think it does in some ways. Like all things, you know, what is the rule that we know? There are no bad assets, only badly priced assets.
That's very true.
However, in Vlahovic's case, he's very different, obviously, from Gabriel Jesus. I think, look, there's no question they need another striker. Do I like the idea that you bring in Vlahovic? He settles. He learns the system. I mean, he's athletic. He's tall. He's technically very good. He's had a bit of an up-and-down time at Juve. You plop him in there, and then maybe when Gabriel Jesus comes back, maybe you can use Jesus on the wing in certain days, certain games. Maybe you can use them together in certain games.
Yeah.
You know, it opens up a range of possibility. I personally think I like having a big man option in my teams, and I think this is something that Arsenal really are missing.
Yeah,
so
it
would make a lot of sense, but then can you do it at the right price?
Yeah, that's true.
Jules, plenty of speculation about Jean-Felix and his future.
Yeah, again, Gabby, but this time all the noise that we hear coming out of either Atletico Madrid, who I think clearly now also want him out, from his own camp, which is Jorge Mendes, Justy Foot, all of that is pointing towards him leaving the club in the summer, in January, sorry, so before the summer even. The only issue I've got, Gabby, is once you've paid someone 120 million euros like that, right, and even before going into amortization and how many years...
Oh, I wanted to give an amortization lecture!
But like, how much can you really, realistically now, and this is serious, ask for Joao Felix, who's still young and has showed at times in this World Cup how good he could be?
How much would I pay for him?
Yeah, or how much, if you were Atletico Madrid CEO or sporting director, like, you know.
All right. I think Joao Felix is a project. He is still a project. He is not the finished article. There is a player in there.
Yeah.
You need to find the right club for him that's willing to work for him and turn him into it.
You can't be too greedy either, otherwise no one would buy him.
For me, I would, again, depends on the club, but I think if I'm Atleti and I get 60 for him, I am biting your hand off. I am very happy.
I would have said exactly the same amount.
Really?
Yeah,
because a lot of people would have said, oh, but the prices keep going up. I'm like, yeah, but this dude's been stop-start. At no stage, has he carried Atletico Madrid for more than a month. Right? He's had periods where he was really good for Atletico Madrid, but then something happened and whatever. And, you know, he's not 19 anymore.
No, you're right.
There is a player in there, no question about it. But
I agree with you. And Gab, we've been hit by two tragic deaths of colleagues here in Qatar. Khalid Al-Mislam, a photographer from the Qatari network, Al-Khas, and Grant Wall, the elder statesman of American football writers and a man that you knew very well.
Yeah, so with all respect to Khalid Al-Mislam, I don't know him. So I'm going to, my thoughts obviously go out to him and his family. As far as Grant Wall is concerned, it is something that certainly hit me, hit a lot of us very hard. For me personally, I first met Grant more than 25 years ago ahead of the World Cup in France in 1998. We lived together at the World Cup in South Africa. I had the opportunity to stay with him and his wife in the States. He stayed with us in London as recently as last month in November, and before that in September as well. And what I remember most overarching about Grant was the fact that he was so kind. He had this general kindness and this curiosity about the world. You know, you can make joke about sort of Midwestern politeness. But, you know, this is the guy who made his own bed every morning. This is the guy who was an Eagle Scout. You know, this is the guy who would stop and he would talk to everybody. In terms of the game in the U.S., he was obviously a big advocate for women's football. I think he was one of the first full-time football writers in the United States, which seems crazy if you think about where the game is now.
Yeah.
You know, Grant had just turned 49 years old. In fact, he passed away the day after his birthday. So we're talking about the 90s, early 2000s, and he was one of the first. You could count them, you know, literally in two or three fingers. So in terms of what he did for the game, I think is tremendous in terms of promoting the sport in America. Yeah. It's a tragic loss, obviously, first and foremost, for those of us who knew him as a friend, as a person, as a guy who was proud of his quirks. Did you know that, I mentioned this the other day, but he was the kind of guy who, he had toy poodles, and his toy poodles are named Coco and Zizou for Zinedine Zidane. And as toy poodles age, apparently, they often have dental problems. So Grant would be the one brushing their teeth every night, as if they were his children, which, you know, not my thing.
Yeah.
But Grant did it with such an honesty, and he talked about it with such an honesty. I was just an absolutely remarkable person who just touched a lot of lives. Right, on that sad note, I'm hoping people can take the positives of what happened in terms of, in Grant's specific, all the lives that he touched. But I think also the broader lesson is to go and to spend time with the people you love, your friends, your family members, and obviously work and whatnot is very important. But, you know, those things will pass, whereas friendship, family, love will stay with you for a long time. We're going to be back on Tuesday night.
That's right.
In between the two semifinals, we'll be previewing the second semifinal, which of course is France against Morocco.
Yeah.
Basically a derby. And looking back, of course, at the first semifinal. So join us then. And until then, love the game, love your neighbor, and love yourself.